Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel-Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world.
Hello, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. It's Thursday, January 13th. I'm Jessica Steinberg. I'm joined this morning by military correspondent Judah Ari Gross and Ops and Blogs editor Miriam Hirschlag. Hello to you both.
Morning, Jessica.
Hi, Jessica.
Today we'll be discussing a range of pieces, including the movie script-like story about a Shin Bet arrest of five Israelis, a slight increase in soldiers' deaths over the last year, and bloggers' accounts of advocacy for Haredi victims of abuse, and the government reforms for kosher certification and conversion. Okay, that's a lot, but we will break it down for you. Judah, let's start with you. Tell us more about this Shin Bet case of an Iranian operative working with Jewish Israelis. It's hard to really believe this story. Tell us what you got.
So over the past few months, the Shin Bet has arrested at least five Jewish Israelis who are suspected of being recruited and acting as assets of an Iranian intelligence operative who, in most of the cases, but not all of them, pretended to be a Jewish Iranian still living in Tehran. These were not deeply embedded, you know, Israelis who work in high positions of government or who have, you know, clear access to, you know, sensitive materials. They were sort of everyday people. Most of them were middle-aged women who, from the indictments, it seems, were sort of brought into this sort of somewhat romantically. There's lots of cases of him, of this operative, Rambod Namdar, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, sort of complimenting them on their appearance and in some cases requesting nude photographs of these women. So they were sort of brought in and asked to do all sorts of, you know, relatively speaking, benign missions of taking photographs of, you know, military bases and getting the email address for then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and things like that, which really sort of a degree of digging online could kind of turn up easily enough.
Right. It seemed like very mundane things that they were asked to do or provide.
So there's a lot of it was relatively mundane. Some of it wasn't. You know, in some cases, these women were asked to sort of get their sons to join military intelligence units, where that obviously, like if a connection was made, you know, that could be a significant source of information for the Iranians. But then on the other side of things, there was also multiple attempts, some of them successful, to get these women to go abroad to meet this, you know, this Iranian operative, sort of trying to get them to go abroad. In at least one case, it was successful. I mean, nothing violent came of it. But, you know, the fear is, in Israel is that, you know, an Israeli could be sort of taken hostage by Iranian operatives. And then you enter into sort of a different world where Israel's forced to, you know, negotiate a hostage release, things like that. So not a lot came out of this that was particularly damaging to Israeli national security, but it certainly revealed a degree of a certain weak spot that could be exploited. You know, all it takes is that one person who does have a son in a sensitive unit in the military who can send photos and do sort of different things like that. And then this rises to a different level of concern. But for now, sort of this was foiled before anything serious, as far as we know, could come of it. But it's, you know, it's certainly a point of concern for the Shin Bet. It also sort of reveals something that doesn't get discussed a lot, but is sort of a widely known secret that every now and then, Iranian Jews do get permission to come visit relatives of theirs in Israel. So in this case, one of the women who is now being indicted, her niece came to visit from Iran and brought with her some money that was transferred from this intelligence operative. So that's something that sort of happens quietly and doesn't get discussed very, very much. But this sort of brought that a little bit to the fore, which was sort of an interesting thing that it's being openly discussed, and maybe it's being openly discussed in order to limit these kinds of contacts in the future.
It sounds a lot like a script for Tehran for the show, truly. You or someone is going to make this into something for Apple TV or Netflix, right?
Good luck to them.
Right, exactly. Okay, thanks for that, Judah. Miriam, turning to you, blogger Shana Aronson writes about the process she's in as a result of her nonprofit work to provide advocacy for Haredi victims of rape, incest, molestation, cover-up, intimidation. Could you tell us more about that piece?
Right, Jessica. So Shanna Aronson is the executive director of Magen for Jewish Communities, which, as you mentioned, deals with protecting victims of sexual abuse and sort of dealing with its effects on communities. Her piece is one of many articles that came in the wake of the case of Chaim Walder, who was an Israeli Haredi rabbi and writer of literature for children and adolescents, who was accused of sexual abuse by dozens of victims and then killed himself, leaving enormous questions and pain in this community. Shanna works with victims. So her piece told the story of a prominent Rosh Yeshiva, that's a dean of a religious academy, calling her and asking for input on what he should include in his letter to talk about this Chaim Walder abuse case, and how could he support the victims. And her response was, speak to the victims. And so he said, sure, you know, make that happen. And she drove over with seven people who were victims and said that she sat there listening to stories of rape, incest, molestation, devastation, cover-up, intimidation. And she said it was a physically painful experience to hear this. There were a lot of tears, and that the pressure was really tangible, and the tremendous weight that victims carry. And at the same time, being empowered to speak, and, you know, being asked to sort of courageously persevere and present themselves and their stories was critical, and sort of lays a path forward for healing. So she says if there was ever a time for the Haredi community to allow survivors to take over and write the next chapter, it must be now. Magnify survivors' voices. Our communities will be safer, healthier, and more just for it.
Miriam, how many pieces like this are you finding that you're getting in the last couple of weeks following the events of Chaim Walder's suicide?
Many, dozens. I think the trauma of this event and the fact that it sort of lays bare these very painful experiences is, you know, makes sense that people are going to be writing and arguing about it. And there's also, you know, numerous pieces on the blogs that where people are feeling very defensive and feeling like, hey, how all of a sudden is the ultra-Orthodox world coming into sights when this abuse happens all across? So there's a bit of what you might think of as whataboutism, but like a sense of feeling criticized and attacked. But I think more powerfully, you know, I've felt about this is that you had the initial sort of social media outpouring and also on our platform outpouring about people's feelings and what they knew and what was hidden. But I actually think that going forward, you know, out 3 months, 6 months, a year, 5 years, these are the things that are, these are the sort of the time periods that are actually more interesting to look at, to see if this was a bubble and then was sort of hidden under the surface, or if there was a cause of change. I mean, if right now I could choose one story to follow, if I were back in my journalism shoes, I would, you know, plant myself in the ultra-Orthodox communities and speak in particular with women about how this is affecting them and in here and sort of quietly follow that story. Because I think that is going to be a really fascinating question. And it really gets to the question of power and control over the message in these very, very closed, sort of controlled communities. So yes, lots of stuff about it. And I believe there will be more, and it will only get more sort of important and interesting to follow.
Right. Thanks, Miriam. Okay, we're going to take a short break. Hey, it's Jessica Steinberg. If you have an important message you'd like to share with people who care deeply about Israel and the Jewish world, there's really no better way to do that than by advertising in our podcasts. Reach the Times of Israel's unique community with an audio ad. For more information, email ads@timesofisrael.com. That's ads@timesofisrael.com.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Judah, back to you. The Israel Defense Forces saw a slight increase in the number of soldiers' fatalities over the past year. And of course, there's also this morning's headlines. Tell us what you can about that. What are we seeing?
The year 2021 saw, as you said, sort of a slight increase in the number of soldiers who died while in service. It was 31 in 2021 compared to 28 the year before. So, you know, a slight increase, but nothing really signifying a significant trend. As it has been in the past few years, the leading cause of death among soldiers was suicides. At least 11 soldiers are believed to have taken their lives, and there's another two whose deaths are sort of currently listed as accidents, but sort of as the, you know, but the investigations may lead to suicide being the cause of death there too. And what's pretty significant in that is that of the 11 soldiers who are believed to have committed suicide, three of them were members of the Ethiopian Israeli community. One of the other two that may have been a suicide is also an Ethiopian Israeli, which means that, you know, roughly a third of the suicides in the IDF were by Ethiopians. There have been a number of studies over the year that show a higher rate of suicides among Ethiopian Israelis compared to the general population. So this is something that sort of the IDF is aware of and, you know, has said that it's trying to address. But obviously, it's a source of concern when you have sort of one specific group that's showing, you know, such a higher rate of suicide. It clearly shows that their issues are not being addressed in the way that they need to. You know, it should be said the IDF, there's a lot of discussion that can be had about this, but the IDF has been, generally speaking, has been pretty successful at preventing suicides within the military. Like, the rate of suicide is below that of the general population. Some of that is due to sort of some programs that were put into place that are pretty well documented as being successful. The IDF, you know, limited access to guns to soldiers when they didn't need them. They've also sort of better trained officers to notice the signs of somebody who may have suicidal tendencies so that they can be sort of directed to a mental health officer. But there's also some allegations that the IDF is somewhat juking the stats and is releasing soldiers who have mental health issues. And then sort of if that person goes on to commit suicide, then, you know, that's not a suicide within the military. You know, that's something that happens outside of the military. But that is not the majority of cases. But it is something that's sort of discussed of exactly how you do the counting and how you figure out who's responsible for what. In general, though, the IDF has been, you know, on a pretty clear downward trend in terms of the number of suicides. It's held pretty steady over the past few years at about 10. In addition, the second most leading cause of deaths in the IDF, as it has been in many years past, is car accidents in the civilian world, sort of not within the military, but outside of the military. A soldier goes home for the weekend and is driving and is in a wreck. So these are numbers that are sort of interesting to get into. They don't really show a dramatic trend sort of one way or another. But the issue of Ethiopian suicides is certainly something that that the IDF sort of says it knows needs to be addressed, but is something that we'll be sort of following up on to see sort of what programs are being put into place to protect this community that clearly is somehow falling through the cracks.
Thank you, Judah. And Miriam, finally to you, looking at another blogger piece that you have about the first stages of the kosher certification reforms that are being put in place. Blogger Benjamin Perret offers a very fine-tuned look at these reforms.
Right. Professor Porat is, he's a senior fellow at the Israel Democracy Institute and is the director of the Institute for Jewish Law at the Hebrew University. So he kind of drills down these two areas that are undergoing radical change in the Israeli rabbinate's control and authority in Israeli life. And one is the area of kashrut supervision, and the other is conversion, the area of conversion to Judaism. So these are reforms being introduced by Minister of Religious Services, Matan Kahana, and the chief rabbinate and their supporters have sort of been up in arms over the sense that they're being challenged and claiming that these are going to bring a sort of anarchy to Jewish life in Israel. But according to these reforms, the chief rabbinate will no longer have the power to award kashrut certification directly, and instead they'll oversee multiple sources of kashrut certification with different perspectives. And then the other big area, conversion reform, city rabbis will be empowered to perform conversions. So again, these have caused a lot of backlash. What Porat argues is that these actually do not undermine the power of the rabbinut, and they are actually both very different. One involves privatization. I mean, kashrut, among other things here, is a business. And also is, you know, we know that even among the most observant, religiously observant of communities, there's a tremendous diversity of rules and restrictions that are observed, you know, to begin with between Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews, but also in different communities. And actually, it reflects a situation that's already going, these changes to kashrut, because if you look at any package in Israel, you'll see kind of a million different kashrut certification stamps, hechshers, from different sources. So this just sort of puts something that's already structured that way and existing that way into effect and gives the rabbinate a more supervisory role. The conversion situation is a bigger one because it defines the most basic question in this country of who is a Jew, and you wouldn't privatize that, but you do want to decentralize that, according to Professor Porat, who points out that historically conversion was a local event that happened with the local, you know, through the local rabbi, and that sort of puts it back into where it belongs. And he says privatization is the right strategy for kashrut, decentralization is the right strategy for conversion, and it will allow a very welcome diversity in religious services while also it maintaining the sort of common denominator of control that and centralization that exists in the conversion field. So it's worth reading for those who are interested. I found it quite interesting.
This argument about kashrut is happening about sort of the rabbinate's kashrut oversight. And what's, you can say, hypocritical or interesting at the very least, is that generally speaking, the ultra-Orthodox parliamentarians that are opposing this, generally speaking, the Ultra-Orthodox community does not follow the rabbinate's kashrut certification. They go for more stringent ones. So it's sort of they're opposing something that they don't really support from the start in their personal lives. So it really becomes more of a political issue and one of power and financial interest than one that really has to do with their own personal sort of religious observation, just as a small aside, adding to the complexity of the issue.
Thank you, Miriam. And thank you, Judah. Thanks for joining us on today's Daily Briefing. We'll be back on Sunday with the next Daily Briefing. In the meantime, you can listen to Times Will Tell tomorrow, Friday, as I interview writer Sherry Mandel about the one-woman ensemble play based on her book, The Blessing of a Broken Heart, along with director Yael Vallier and actress Rebecca Sykes. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time.
Shalom.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle Singer from the Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.